Hello, welcome to another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Ryan, how are you today?
I'm doing great. You?
Always great. I'm great, too.
I'm always great.
Well, we have our favorite guest back in the podcast room with us again.
He says
crowd
that.
Favorite.
Yep.
You guys say that to everyone.
Not everyone.
Not everyone?
No, not everyone.
Most of them, though, really.
That's what I thought.
We don't talk to all of them as much as we talk to you.
That's probably true. So Glenn Longaball, our premier ag agronomist, is joining us in the podcast room. But before we do anything, we have to start with the question of the day.
Oh, yay.
Yes.
That's a good one.
Glenn?
Yes, sir.
The question of the day is, tell us your favorite decade and why. And now, do they have to have lived in the decade?
It's your question.
Any decade.
Context.
But you better know something about
context.
It.
You always say that.
Well, it is about context, right? So, the 80s were good to me because, you know, I was in college in the 80s, and that's, you know, one of the best times of your life, right? The 90s is when my kids were born, and they were little, and that's a lot of fun, too.
Yeah.
You know, the millennium was, you know, kind of the height of my professional career, you know, probably.
I thought this was the height of your professional.
Now, what he's saying is we got him on the downhill slide.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
You got me on the downhill slide, right? So, I can't go all hours of the night and day like I could at that time.
Well, you should be about depreciated out, sounds like.
You think so.
We should be at a discount.
But you know what? Today, you know, I don't think you're a very good agronomist probably until you get at the very end of your career because there's only so many experiences you can have, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, the farm's doing well, and I got grandbabies now, which is maybe even more fun than having your own kids, right? Because you can send them home, and you can spoil the tar out of them.
Give them a Butterfinger and a Mountain Dew and send them home.
So it doesn't get much better than what it is right now, but probably the 90s or today would be my two favorite decades.
They're very good.
Yep.
All right. I don't know what I expected, but I don't know if I would think that. But the grandbaby certainly skewed you.
It did. Yeah. No question. We had Bennett last night, and it's just great.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's just great fun. Oh, he stays at Pop Pop and Dee Dee's a lot. Well, so full disclosure, my daughter has twin girls, too, as well as Bennett. And they're a handful, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so when you have three toddlers, you know, two babies. It's overwhelming.
Yeah.
It's pretty overwhelming for mom.
They seem to move a lot.
They do.
Ryan?
I'll go with the 90s.
The 90s?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, got my license in 90. And so you had all high school, college, married, all of that stuff.
Good
so,
time.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, that did a lot in the 90s. So, yeah, I'll go with the 90s. I told you I was going to go with the 1430s, but then you guys started trying to get
specifics
out of it. I didn't really, I was trying to be funny, and you guys sort of took the fun out of it. So, go ahead.
Well, mine would have to be the 80s, I think. And only because I think that it was such a simple time. I was in high school. Graduated in 86 from high school, date myself, but no cell phones.
What year?
86.
You graduated high school. Okay.
Yep. No cell phones. You could say anything you wanted to. I mean, you might not have any friends. I mean,
sure.
Or get punched in the nose, but you could do whatever you wanted to do. Parents, you didn't know where everybody was, right? I mean, you left the home, and heck, nobody knew where you were till you came back.
Yeah,
so,
till dark.
Yeah, but I think the 80s would be
cool,
and the music was pretty good.
Music was pretty good. Yeah. I'll give you that.
So obviously, Sal was not farming in the 80s.
No, I was not,
because the 80s sucked.
Yeah, the 80s for ag was not a good time.
Terrible.
No, I don't know how mom and dad did it with the farm.
Yeah,
it was a tough time period.
Yeah.
Well, before we get started on the topic of the day, you just got back from a hunting trip.
I did, and we had a wonderful time, right? Had a great group of guys. We got there, and the camp was pretty full, and we were pretty anxious about it because we had extra hunters in camp that we were not anticipating.
But, you didn't know them.
And we didn't know them, but they became family pretty quick. a couple guys from Missouri and a couple guys from Texas, father and sons. And then we had some local farmers from Argentina that were in our camp also that we were not expecting. And one of them could speak really, really good English. So it was, we utilized him a lot, but it was a great time.
Went to Argentina.
It was Argentina. We were hunting in the Pampas region, which would be south and south and west of Buenos Aires. So we didn't get to see the good crop. The good crop ground is all to the west and north of Buenos Aires towards Uruguay. And we didn't get to see that. You know, we didn't go anywhere near Rosario where they load the ships. But it was still really interesting and got to see a lot of, you know, rangeland and really crappy corn crops, right? You're looking out there saying, man, that's probably 20 bushel corn or 40 bushel corn.
Oh, wow.
Kind of reminds you of if you've ever been across the High Plains, the dry land corn in western Kansas or eastern Colorado. It's about like that.
Wow.
So,
and what were you hunting?
So we were hunting primarily red stag. And they did have some other exotic animals on this farm. Red stag have been there for lots and lots of years.
Isn't that what Bledsoe said he wanted to do? That was his dream.
That was his bucket list.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, Bledsoe would really like this place.
Thank God we didn't have them on together.
Oh, no. We'll have to put the picture up of this mammoth.
Yeah. Well, you know, he was good. He was really long, but he wasn't very massive. And he didn't have great big crowns. But I was tickled to death with him. I was several days in before I got one killed. The first night, I actually had almost all the big ones that were on that part of the ranch were right in front of me the first night. And I had a calamity in the blind where I hit a tree limb, the overhanging tree limb, you know, because they had me pretty far from the water. I was hunting over water. And it skipped an arrow off his back. It actually hit him kind of broadside. And I was so shook up because I couldn't hardly shoot out of this blind. It was set up for rifle hunters, not bow hunting. Your feet were in front of you and kind of in a pit with a, you know, a piece of steel, you know, like corrugated metal and a bunch of brush stacked up.
I would love to have corrugated metal and brush while I'm trying to be quiet. I think that's a combination of stone.
Yeah. Well, it was in front of you, right? And then they had a pit dug out for your feet, but it was like I said, it was made for a rifle hunter. Well, a rifle hunter sets with his feet in front of you, where an archer, you shoot to your left if you're a right-handed shooter. And it was really awkward. I was shooting with off my right knee and my left foot, trying to stay as low as I could and yet clear the blind. And there's lots of interesting things. We probably hadn't been in the blind 15, 20 minutes, and I went, psst, 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 finally got my guide's attention, who can't speak a bit of English, right? I mean, the whole week you're spending with
in contrast, you can't speak a bit of...
Right.
I can't speak any Spanish.
Actually, you were at his house. Yeah,
I was. I was. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I finally got his attention and pointed out, and he's like, what? And I was like... And I was trying to hand gesture him. There was a some kind of viper, right? Looked like a small rattlesnake, but no rattles, right where I'd been sitting on the sand, right there where I'd been sitting. So this is only like 15 minutes in. And anyway, he took his knife and whacked it. And we saw a few snakes while we were there, but it was, for the most part, it was really neat. I mean, it was wonderful trip.
It must have been a good camera angle, because Glenn looked like he was like this big, about an inch tall, behind this great big red stag. It fills a picture up. We'll put a picture up.
That was, I was very proud of that picture, right? It was done. I color corrected it. And probably the coolest thing is you'll notice that I'm in focus and the stag's in focus, but the rest of it's all kind of blurred out. What you would expect from a, you know, like this group back here behind us.
Professionals.
Yeah, professionals, where you had a really, you know, large f-stop or, you know, small f-stop number, but a big open lens where just the stag and I were focused and the rest of it was kind of blurred. It's a beautiful photo.
You could do a lot with Photoshop.
Yes. Thinking the same thing.
Well, some of that you can, you know, the color correction you can do post-production, but it's a whole lot better
if you
do it.
Now the fish story comes out.
It's a lot better if you do it pre-production. But if you'll notice in that photograph, my bow is on the front side of the stag, and you can tell that it's still a pretty good stag.
Okay.
And the deal was, he was probably the smallest of our group, believe it or not.
That's hard to believe.
It was. Well, he was as long as the others, but in fact longer than some of the others, but he didn't have big heavy crowns, didn't have the mass. Rod, my buddy Rod, who's head of USA Archery, shot one that you would have had to took both hands to get around the main beam. It was that
big. Oh, my
big.
Gosh.
It was only, the main beams were like 30 inches, a little over 30 inches, but it was just crazy massive. Tines going everywhere. And of course, you know, that makes for pretty happy hunters.
Well, we better get started.
Sure.
That's the hunting program. So that's another episode. Yeah.
It would have taken nearly as long, because if I were 15 minutes into a trip and saw a poisonous snake, it'd have been over for me.
Yeah, I'm out. Like,
there's got to be something at the cabin we can do, right?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I'll leave these guys several pictures so they
can. All right.
That'd be good.
It was beautiful.
Well, Glenn, your other passion is agronomy.
Absolutely.
And kind of timestamp this. Timestamp this. We are at the beginning of April where we're doing this recording. April to mid-April, and it's been wet here in southern Indiana.
Yes.
We've got a lot of cover crops out that are getting bigger, and we've got to terminate the cover crops. That's one issue. I guess tell us what all we should be thinking about as growers and account managers and
Sure. Everybody
else.
Yeah, great question. So, yeah, when we're fixing to turn the table between early pre-plant herbicides and burn down and actually just pre-plant or pre-emerge. And there's a big difference in how you approach those, right? When we think about early burn down, right, early pre-plant, say a March application, then we can go in with, things just like glyphosate, maybe 2,4-D, maybe add some metribuzin, and, we can make these applications, and we have lots of time, right? We have time on our side, and typically we have very small cover crops, right? So it's easy to get them killed. We have lots of time to make sure that it's all brown before the crop is established. Now we find ourselves in a position where the next time it dries up, we won't just be spraying. We'll be spraying and planting. We'll be doing everything together. And the conundrum there, the problem with that is typically we want to put all of our residual package with the burn down. And you're saying, well, gee, that's more modes of action. It's more product. Seems like that should even aid make burn down even easier. Well, it does, excepting the glyphosate really becomes easily antagonized by other chemistries, right? So glyphosate, even though we like to think that it doesn't really do a lot of heavy lifting, it still does, right? It kills a lot of winter annuals. It's really our primary defense at killing cereal grains and these cover crop species that we plant intentionally. And so when you add things like atrazine, say with corn chemistry, or you add metribuzin with soybean chemistry, those two are both group 5 herbicides. They're PS2 inhibitors, and they tend to have a really deleterious effect on the activity of glyphosate, right? In other words, we antagonize the glyphosate where it doesn't kill those grasses very evenly. Which is what we're trying to do, right? And so you're probably saying, well, that's not a big deal in soybeans, and it's not, right? Even if it takes a month for them to completely terminate, that isn't that deleterious to soybeans. But on corn hates that, right? We know from Dr. Swanton's data that corn is really sensitive to the color of light that is reflected onto its bottom side, right, into its canopy, because that's how corn orients itself natively to the other corn plants around it, right? And if you kind of halfway terminate a cover crop and it's still green and corn comes up in that green mat, it can't differentiate what is cover crop and what is its neighbor, which it normally tries to align and get perpendicular with, right?
To get more light.
Get more light. It's all about managing light. And so it's possible that if you don't get it terminated, then you basically have screwed up that plant physiologically for the rest of its life. So it really is a big deal. And so there are strategies that we use, right? I don't want to just tell you about the problems, yeah, right? There are strategies.
Well, that's the conundrum.
Yeah, so these are all the...
I don't really have any answers. Yeah, I've got some problems.
Yeah. So we've kind of spelled out the problems, right? There's lots of pitfalls whenever you get into, like, pre-emerge, because now you're treating... Yes, you can use non-selective herbicides that you can't put over the top of soybeans, but you only get one chance, right? There's no do-overs. Everything after that stage has got to be something that is capable of going over the crop, over the top. And so, you know, let's start with corn, right? We just spelled out probably the most damning is corn. And what I would recommend is when we get into pre-emerge, right? You know, not early pre-plant, but we get into pre-emerge, really it's a great time to think about changing from glyphosate and 2,4-D, and which oftentimes 2,4-D has a plant back restriction. If you work ground, you can't use 2,4-D in front of corn, right? Mm-hmm. But so not only have you got those restrictions, but you probably ought to think about going to something like Gramoxone, right? And so those folks that do weed and feed that are already putting down UAN in front of corn for their first dose, you know, a couple of pints of Gramoxone will go a long way. And you'll terminate that cover crop just immediately, right? Within a few days, that cover crop will be dead and brown, and then you don't have to worry about the potential problems associated with having halfway terminated cover crop in corn.
Because of synergies with the 28.
That's right, because of synergies with 28. So, and metribuzin helps also, right? Gramoxone and metribuzin, gramoxone and atrazine, right? Anytime you put a group 22, which is what gramoxone is, it's a PS1 inhibitor with a PS2 inhibitor, there is significant synergy there. Unlike when you put a group 5, right, which is a PS2 inhibitor, in with glyphosate, then there's antagonism. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, I would love to oversimplify it, but like most things that are biology and agronomy, the more you know, the more you understand that, boy, this is really complex.
Well, it explains probably a lot of times when we see these cover crops like wheat or rye that don't get killed very effectively, and you see the corn coming up in them, and we're heavy no-till, especially south of State Road 50 coming through southern Indiana, and those are a perennial problem.
I mean, absolutely.
They just never, if you're using glyphosate, it seems like you don't get another chance.
Sure, sure. And sometimes we're left almost with no choice, right? So if we're doing a burn down in front of soybeans, and you know that things like metribuzin or dimetric are going to antagonize the glyphosate, but guess what? If you don't put them in, now you're going to have mare's tail.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's the first line of defense for mare's tail. So we have adopted some new strategies, and I know that a few of the guys are kind of going back to an older chemistry called flumioxazin or Valor. And we started adding that in with our early burn downs, which gives us a chance to put another mode of action out there that has a fair amount of residual activity, which is a good day. It doesn't cause a lot of antagonism with glyphosate, and yet it also has a chance to anchor before we have an established crop, right? So when we use it pre-emerge, not early, not pre-plant, but when we use it pre-emerge, the peril with those group 14s, whether it's safafenicil, flumioxazin, or sulfentrazone, the brands would be like the Verdic sharpened brands, right? The flumioxazin would be the Valor Extreme brands, and then the sulfentrazone brands would be like Sonic Authority brands, right? Spartan. When we use those pre-emerge, right? In other words, the crop's been planted, we make that application, boy, you can really flirt with crop injury, right? Because a lot of times you'll make that application, it's pre-emerge, the beans are in the ground, there's no harm, no foul. But if the crop is emerging about the time you get the first rainfall event, you get a lot of splash off of the residue and off of the soil that moves that chemistry onto this emerging seedling. And if it splashes onto the mesocotyl, the hypocotyl, mm-hmm. that's that neck, right? Or onto the cotyledons, you oftentimes see a fair amount of injury. So,
and that's a death, right?
I mean, it's not always death, but if it's on the hypocotyl, it does oftentimes result in it is terminal. If it happens to the cotyledons, most times it just kind of sets the plant back for a while. There is, you know, a pair of unifoliates is going to come out just behind the cotyledons, and then trifoliates from that point on. And all of those have nodes, right? Contrary to the how a soybean develops by Iowa State, right? It shows no axillary buds at the cotyledons, but there are at the cotyledon node there are buds there.
So how do we overcome that how do we overcome
that crop injury?
Yes, not the crop injury, but the glyphosate, the antagonism that we got in the spray tank.
Yeah, so one way you could do it is make sequential treatments, right? So let's say
that goes over really popular.
I know it does. I understand that because it not just means another application.
Love that.
But here's the deal. It is it better to make an application on the front end and have it behind you, or potentially have to make multiple applications in crop where it's typically more expensive, right? So you could very easily go out there. Like I said, in some cases we've moved from metribuzin in the first pass, gone to flumioxazin or some other group 14, and then put the flumioxazin the metribuzin, the dimetric, in the pre-emerge pass, right? Now we're looking at one pass probably, right? And in that case, you can either, put them all together and then expect to have to come back and clean up the grass again where you had antagonism. Or you could just try to do a early burn down pass and then forego the metribuzin completely and, basically make an earlier first post-emerge pass. Mm.
But you are gaining some residual with the metribuzin.
Absolutely.
That's 3 to 5 ounces or whatever it is. I forget now. But, you're gaining some.
Yeah, so in dry metribuzin, you're right. The rate range that we've been using, which Bill Johnson with Purdue swears is not enough, right, is typically 3 to 5 ounces, which means 6 to 10 ounces of dimetric liquid, because we're almost all using the liquid formulation now because it's easier, it goes into solution easier.
He just said I was a has-been. That's fine.
No. I did not imply.
Classic.
There you go.
This is new technology.
Right. I'm retro. I just said the 90s.
Yeah, that's right.
So the newest technology is liquid metribuzin, and it doesn't hang up in the machines as bad and goes in, it just goes in easier. So again, right, it's kind of 6 of 1, half a dozen of the other. If you've got just winter annuals, and there's not a big cover crop out there to kill, then yeah, I would put the metribuzin in with my burn down and probably put the first pass of residuals in if it's a pre-emerge pass, right? And when I say residuals, metribuzin is residual, and typically the group 15s are residuals. And for those that are not familiar with their group numbers, group 15s would be Outlook, Warrant, Zidua, Dual, Define, or that chemistry, right, would be a group 15. So I don't really like using those in March, because by the time we get to the stage of the year where water hemp, which is our primary target, comes up, we've already lost a big part of that chemistry.
Yeah,
that's one of the reasons why we're looking at maybe some of these other chemistries, other group 14s. So, we talked a lot about group numbers, and I don't know if we have enough time, but
sure we do.
Yeah, group numbers are really, really important because it allows us to all talk the same language, right? When I was young, when we talked about group 15s, we talked about shoot inhibitors, right? And then,
I miss those days.
Yeah, we got more sophisticated. We talked about the chemical families. We talked about acetanilids. Well, guess what? Metolachlor and alachlor were both, they were both acetanilids. But then whenever we had Outlook, dimethylamide is not an acetanilid, but it is a chloroacetamide. So then we talked about the whole group as being chloroacetamides. And then we talked about them, kind of went back to, let's just talk about shoot inhibitors. Well, technically it's a very long chain fatty acid inhibitor. So you could describe that group of chemistries in about 5 different ways. But the easiest way is to use the group number, and it's a group 15, right? And that's our primary, that's the primary chemistry we use, both corn and soybeans, to try to control grasses and small seeded broadleaves out of both broadleaf and grass crops. So that's group 15. Group 1 is ACCase inhibitors, right? That would be things like the FOPs and DIMs would be the family. It's the mode of action is it's a growing point disruptor. So you think about clethodim and fluazafop. These would be things like section or fusilade. They screw up grass crops, right? They have little or no activity on any broadleaves, but they will screw up grass crops. And that's group 1 herbicides. ACCase inhibitors. Group two herbicides would be the ALS inhibitors. And what ALS inhibitors do is they screw up the synthesis of one of three key amino acids, right? So they screw up amino acid synthesis. Group nine, Roundup, also screws up. It's also a protein synthesis inhibitor. I say protein. It screws up the synthesis of three key amino acids, and you have to have those amino acids to make proteins. And then you get into group threes. That would be your the yellows. That would be things like pendimethalin, treflan, prowl. Those are called microtubule inhibitors and used to be called root inhibitors, your root hair inhibitors. And people think the microtubule it's describing the little root hairs. It's not. It's describing when cells go through asexual reproduction, what we call mitosis, right? The cells divide from a diploid cell into two haploid cells and then reproduce the other half of the other set of gametes, right? And in that, you guys probably remember in high school, prophase, metaphase, right? And there's these little strands.
Not
that
a lot.
Pull.
I do. Yeah. You don't remember that?
What?
So, you don't remember that?
Yeah.
Oh, you said 86. I forgot. Yeah. They probably weren't talking about it.
They hadn't invented them yet. Yeah.
That probably came out in 88. Yeah.
So the micro books. Yeah. I probably got into too much depth here, but the microtubules. Yeah. The microtubules refer to the little strands that pull the DNA apart. Right.
I was good in some subjects. Sure. Okay. Not math necessarily, yeah. But go ahead.
So we don't use a lot of group threes anymore, but you know what? We probably should, right? Group threes, they have a few skeletons, right? They have a few problems, but they were pretty effective on small seeded broadleaves. Group fours, you guys are very familiar with. What are group fours, guys? That's the.
Go ahead, sir. You're so freaking smart.
Yeah, it's the growth regulators, right? Yeah. So when you think of
2,4-D's and dicamba.
2,4-D's, phenoxies, right? The phenoxies and the benzoic acids like 2,4-D and dicamba respectively. Clopyrrolid, right? The stinger molecule is in that. It's in that mode of action. And we don't really know exactly how that mode of action works, right? We know or we don't know what the exact site of action. We know the mode of action is that it's these are auxins or synthetic auxins, and it causes a lot of epinasty and adventitious growth, but we don't really know the site of action. Group 5, 6, and 7, we'll talk about those together. That would be, 5s would be the triazines. They're all PS2 inhibitors, right? So they
photosynthetic.
That photosystem 2 is what they work on, right? Wow. And so dimetric, atrazine, simazine, cyanazine, which would be Bladex, all of those are group 5s. Group 6 would be basagran or benazon. We don't use a lot of that anymore. Group 7 is another one that's been cached. That would be Linuron. If you remember Lorox when we were young, it was Lexone and Lorox, right? It was Syncor and Lorox. Those were really common chemistries. That is still in the same mode of action, different side of action. Group 8s we don't use anymore, but some of the listeners probably remember using a radicane and Sutan, right? Those were the thiocarbamates. Mm-hmm. Group 9 we've already talked about. That is glyphosate, and it screws up key amino acid synthesis in the plant. Group 10 has become a very important mode of action for us. Group 10 would be glufosinate, right? That would be Liberty. And what it screws up is the glutamine synthesis cycle, right? So glutamine is a really important enzyme to help with the conversion of nitrate into ammonia, because plants use amines for to make amino acids, right? That's where the name amino acid comes from. That's an NH2. What plants take up is nitrate, right? NO3. For that reduction reaction to take place, you have to have this specific enzyme, and that's what Liberty screws up, right? It screws up the glutamine synthesis cycle. We don't really use any 11s. 12s and 13s would be basically they're, well, let's talk about 12s, 13s, and 27s are all pigment inhibitors, right? Whether we're talking about 13s would be diterpene, command. It would be that group. Group 27s would be the HPPD inhibitors. Man, Sal, really,
sure.
He hit a home run right there. And he was absolutely correct, right? So we use we rely.
This would be Callisto we're talking about now.
Absolutely,
come on now.
If you turn everything white with command a few times, and you'll never forget the mode of action.
Sure, yeah. And so all of those. So whether we're talking about 12s, 13s, or 27s, and we become increasingly dependent on group 27s. And again, you're right. It's mesotrione. It's azoxyflutol. It's tenbutrione. It's there's a whole plethora of these chemistries, and they're primarily broadleaf herbicides that we use in grass crops, right? And so what that leaves us with are 14s and 15s. And we talked about 15s, right? They're primarily grematicides, but they do have activity on small seeded broadleaves. There's very little resistance to group 15s. But they've never really killed the entire herd, right? It kind of thins the herd down so that the other chemistries have a chance of killing them off. Group 14s, we kind of bypassed it. Group 14s, we used to be very dependent on. Water hemp and palmer are resistant to a lot of group 14s, but most of the group 14s that they're resistant to is one family of group 14. So group 14, by the way, is PPO, that's protoporphyrin oxidase, and its role in the plant is kind of the disposal system, right? It helps get rid of all those superoxides, those free radicals that are produced in the photosynthesis process, right? So when you reduce CO2 into glucose, right, if you look at the net, there is a huge loss of oxygen somewhere, and that oxygen produces O2, hydrogen peroxide, which is H2O2 or hydroxyl ions, OH is tetraoxide, ozone, which is three oxygens together, but all of these are really, all of these metabolites of oxygen are really very reactive. And what they tend to do, if you screw up protoporphyrin, which is kind of this disposal system, they are released into the cytoplasm and they react with the membranes and they disrupt those. So you used to think of group 14s.
Cell membrane disruptors.
Cell membrane disruptors. And that's what they do. It's these free radicals are released, right? Free radicals are what your wife is trying to get you to avoid, right? She wants you to drink grape juice and these colorful foods because they are antioxidants, right? Because sure. We associate oxidation with premature aging. And that's what we do. We basically are radically prematurely aging these plants by screwing up the disposal system. The free radicals are released. It screws up the membranes. The membranes then spill out all the organelles into the cytoplasm and basically causes necrosis. And so that really leaves us just two more. One is that we use here would be group 19, which is difluphensapyr. It's an auxin transport inhibitor. And it gives you the same symptomology as like 2,4-D, but it's not 2,4-D. It's used. We don't use it by itself. Difluphensapyr is typically used as a premix with dicamba, and you would know it as status. Mm-hmm. And then the last one would be gramoxone. And gramoxone kind of has a bad rap. It's a group 22. It's a PS1 inhibitor. Basically causes pretty fast necrosis. Because you've again screwed up the photosystem one process to where it's basically turning lots of toxic chemistry into the cells, and that's what causes them to become necrotic pretty quickly. But it's still a great, it gets a bad rap because it is incredibly toxic.
Yep.
And so, but that is an oral toxicity, not a dermal toxicity. And it's probably as safe as most of the chemistry use, simply because Syngenta, the primary supplier, puts an agent in there, so you really couldn't poison yourself.
You don't get to ingest it very long.
You don't get to ingest it very long. Right? You're going to throw it up. But,
yeah.
But it's really a handy tool, right? When we think about corn and its sensitivity to green things growing around it, then it becomes a really handy tool to terminate.
It gets rid of the green.
It does, right?
It does. It gets rid of the green in a hurry.
And even though I, too, have tried to avoid gramoxone, I've used more of it in the last couple of years simply because I don't like to see corn come up in a green cover crop or some shade of green, right? You know, all growers have experienced this. They maybe didn't know to call it antagonism, but when you spray a crop and you spray a cover crop and you go out and plant in it, and it takes 3 weeks for it to die and it looks like a calico cat, right? That was probably because of antagonism. Mm. It wasn't because they didn't do a good job of spraying. It's not because they didn't have the right adjuvants. It's because they had things in the tank that kept the glyphosate or some other chemistry from working. So we've gone through the groups, right? I can tell you that in my mind, there are a few groups that you have to put together if you want to be successful. In soybeans, it's group 5, 14, and 15. If you put those three groups together, right, which would be metribuzin, some kind of PPO inhibitor, and then a very long-chain fatty acid inhibitor, that's group 15. You put those three together, then you stand a much better chance of getting through the season without having to make multiple post-applications, right? Same deal in corn. In corn, it's 14, it's 15, 5, and 27, right? So it's still the group 15, right? It's still not metribuzin, but atrazine or Princep or some other group 5 herbicide. And then it's group 27s, which is your HPPD inhibitors, right? So it's in order, it'd be 5, 15, 27 on corn, and it's 5, 14, 15 on soybeans. That, to me, is kind of the magical combination.
We'll put the group chart up. We'll get the group chart to the guys and let them put the group chart up back and forth while you're talking, just so we can have a good visual there for their listeners on YouTube.
Sure. You know, and I think it's a good exercise for a grower to become familiar, because once they see all of the products, right? I've oftentimes explained this to when we do trainings, that if you look at all of the products and chemistries that are available to us today, it's like looking up at the night sky, right? I mean, the constellations almost touch one another. There's that many products. I mean, it's a plethora, if you will, of products. But out of these, you know, these hundreds of SKUs, thousands of SKUs, right? There really is a very few constellations that give us effective control. Right. And so when you go out and you make a residual application that's a group 15, and then you come back and you post it with a group 15. And by the way, most of those applications were in Enlist soybeans are made with glyphosate and they're made with 2,4-D. You basically have used two effective mode of actions, you know, back to back. And oftentimes if we fail, what do? We come back and make another application
a little more of
a group 4. Right. So in some cases we've made two or three glyphosate applications, group 9 applications, which are not effective on water hemp. They're effective on other things, but not necessarily on water hemp. We've made two, sometimes three applications of group 4, right, in phenoxies, and then we've made one or two applications of group 15. That is a recipe to have lots of problems down the road. So this is why talking about group numbers as opposed to talking about brands, because there's even more brands than there are
actives. That's the thing. Is like, imagine like it's off patent chemistry, but imagine like different brands of cornflakes or something. It's just, there's just, once you have one, then there's all the lookalikes that are exactly the same active ingredient, but a different brand name.
Absolutely. So this is why, you know, we were talking about my best decade. This may be my best decade yet, right? Because the older you get, the more insecure you feel about where we're at in agriculture and the lack of new chemistries, right?
Yeah.
So
that's really scary.
Yeah. And everything old has become new again, right? There was a time when you two, right? Yeah, there was a time before Roundup Ready that you two absolutely, the only reason why you're successful probably is because you had the ability to kill weeds. And mm-hmm. you had the ability to kill weeds because you knew how to combine these different chemistries to create clean fields. Because growers don't come to you to get a science lesson in chemistry. They come to you because they want a clean field. And that's
weeds.
What you, that's right. You guys provided the whole, not the bit.
Okay? Yeah. We'd sell turbo, but we'd spike it with Scepter or something like that.
Absolutely.
It was always a kind of an art. You know, you went out and looked at stuff and found out what didn't work. And then you came back and did something else.
Sure.
So
it was always a good question about what did you do to that field?
Yeah,
absolutely.
I don't remember.
Absolutely.
But Ryan, do we have anything else?
I don't. Nope. That's a good one.
That is a good one. We'll get the chart up with the groups on it so everybody can see that. Glenn, thank you for joining us. Thanks, glad you're feeling better. Glad you made it back from Argentina.
Congratulations on your hunt.
Thank you.
Successful hunt.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.
All right. That was another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. If you like that, please subscribe, and thank you for listening.